Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Novelist, Zen master, and nature writer Peter Matheson came out of the U.S. Navy after World War II and plunged into one of the most celebrated and wide-ranging literary careers of the 20th century. His fiction, travel writing, and spiritual study have taken him all over the world as novelist, naturalist, and activist. 30 years ago, 1978, his great work, The Snow Leopard, was a sensation. Now it's back, and he's talking at a time of national and global challenge. This hour on Point, a conversation with author Peter Matheson. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for a wise eye and big view of the tumultuous moment we're in? Joining me now is Peter Matheson, renowned author, essayist, activist, and environmentalist. He's winner of the National Book Award and co-founder of the Paris Review in the 1950s. He's been writing now for more than a half a century, and his works are considered classics of contemporary American writing. His landmark travel tale of Himalayan exploration, The Snow Leopard, first appeared in print 30 years ago and has just been reissued by Penguin Classics. His latest work of fiction, Shadow Country, which came out earlier this year, reworks his epic trilogy of novels set in the Florida Everglades. The American Dictionary of Literary Biography calls him a shaman of literature. Peter Matheson, welcome to On Point. It's wonderful to have you.
Hi, Tom. That was quite an introduction. Thank you very much.
All the trumpets and flourishes.
Yes, indeed.
Well, we're happy to deliver them for you. I mean, this book in 1978 was such a sensation, National Book Award winner, and of course only one of the many that you've turned out. And I can only imagine as a literally, as a Zen master, I mean, maybe talking about that is something you don't even like to do. But we're at a moment, Peter, and you must feel it too, when the country is kind of looking for some, you know, higher vantage point from which to survey the wreckage and turmoil that we're in the middle of here. You must feel the same thing.
Well, of course I do. People keep saying this is the most important election of our lifetime. And I have had a very long lifetime now, and it certainly is the most important for me. In fact, absolutely critical. I'm a great admirer, of course, of Mr. Obama. I was in Africa last month, and I saw his name posted up in a tiny village on the rim of the Ngorongoro crater, and I heard about somebody else's daughter in Italy who was wearing an Obama button. And she was standing in a long line at the Uffizi Gallery in Florence. Mm. And the Italian people saw that button, and they rushed her up to the front of the line. They were so delighted to see that Obama.
Should be the first upon the Statue of David with her Obama button on.
Well, of course. And I just think you have that sense everywhere you go abroad that the whole world will be so excited. It's the gesture that electing that that guy would restore our credibility in a way that no other act could do. I think it would be thrilling. And, of course, that is not by any means the foremost reason. I would be very sad for Mr. Obama if he were to lose, but I'd be absolutely heartbroken for our country. I think it would be so disastrous to perpetuate the policies of the last 8 years, as Mr. McCain seems intent on doing. I think it's very frightening. And as for his vice president, that's more frightening still. I mean, a creationist, a fundamentalist, is that what we really need to lead the free world? I don't think so.
We want to get the advantage of your many hats and perspectives, but given that we've got the Snow Leopard's sort of 30th anniversary of publication right in front of us here, it may not be a bad place to begin. You were at a kind of a moment of reassessing in your own life. You had lost a wife to cancer in the years just before your journey into the Himalayas. I'm going to ask you to read for us in a moment. You're writing here about glimpsing one's own true nature, and I think a lot of Americans are thinking about our own true nature at the moment. But remind us why you were headed in to the Himalayas, up to Nepal and the Tibetan border in, the early 70s, before the publication of 78, Peter?
Yeah. First of all, I knew Dr. George Schaller in the Serengeti. We were both working in Africa, and we made friends. And he was kind enough to include me on this expedition in search, actually in search of the blue sheep, the mm-hmm. barrel. Mm-hmm. But we both secretly, the secret agenda was the snow leopard. I wanted to see a place called the Crystal Mountain. I was already a Zen student, a very ardent practitioner. And so for both those reasons, the wildlife reason, the exploration was wonderful, but also this, I hesitate to use that word, spiritual element was there. Too. And I thought this is a chance not to be missed to go to such a place.
It was a hard, a hard trip, lots of reality, lots of hard and cold and high and thin when it comes to the air here. There's a piece.
It was a 250-mile hike to get in there too, and in high altitude. So that made it quite a challenge.
And the mountains enveloped you as you went. And helped you get a glimpse of yourself. I wish you just read to give us a sense of what people found and still find so enthralling about the snow leopard. This is where you're pretty deep in the journey, if you could dive in for us, Peter Matheson.
All right. Here's a passage when I'm preparing to leave the Crystal Mountain, which was our destination. And by that time, I'm just I feel part of the place. And I'm homesick, although there's no home. So I'll read a little bit here. Mm-hmm. I grow into these mountains like a moss. I am bewitched. The blinding snow peaks and the clarion air, the sound of earth and heaven in the silence, the requiem birds, the mythic beasts, the flags, great horns, and old carved stones, the rough-hewn Tartars in their braids and homespun boots, the silver ice in the Black River, the Kang, the Crystal Mountain. Also, I love the common miracles, the murmur of my friends at evening, the clay fires of smudgy juniper, the coarse, dull food, the hardship and simplicity, the contentment of doing one thing at a time. When I take my blue tin cup into my hand, that is all I do. We have had no news of modern times since late September, and will have none until December, and gradually my mind has cleared itself, and wind and sun pour through my head as through a bell. We talk little here, yet I am never lonely. I am returned into myself. Having got here at last, I do not wish to leave the Crystal Mountain. I am in pain about it, truly, so much so that I have to smile or I might weep. In another life, this isn't what I know, but how I feel. These mountains are my home. There is a rising of forgotten knowledge, like a spring from hidden aquifers under the earth. To glimpse one's own true nature is a kind of home-going, to a place east of the sun, west of the moon, the home-going that needs no home, like that waterfall on the upper Sulu River, that turns to mist before touching the earth and rises once again into the sky.
Peter Matheson reading from The Snow Leopard, 1978, took many, many Americans where they'd never been before and opened his own introspection during that journey in a way that remains incredibly powerful today. I love that reading. And there, that glimpse of one's own true nature. You know, it was a few months ago, Peter, you were talking with Charlie Rose. You talked about America, Americans. You said, we are a great and terrible nation, speaking of one's own true nature. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think I mean it as an extension of humanity itself. We are a great and terrible species. Here we are, capable of such heights of attainment and insight and wisdom and creation, and yet so terribly unready to use our precious earth in a proper way, in a wise way. We simply have not learned. We have not caught up with our mind in some way. We're still that animal that came out of the distant past. So we are great, but we are also terrible. So that phrase, great and terrible, mm-hmm. it comes from something I read. It was an exploration, an old account of an exploration in the Himalaya by Sven Hayden. He's an old sure. 19th century writer, young. Mm-hmm. And he said, he's describing somebody in there, and this man says, "My name is Arhat, the hunter, and my life is great and terrible. And I found that just a wonderful expression of humanity. I just that's the way it is.
We've been feeling plenty of the terrible lately, but the scale is always good. Have you been back to those mountains? I walked out of Tibet into Nepal, east of where you did years ago, but have you been back since your journey?
I have. I went back in some years ago, not all that long ago, I was invited to go to Mustang, which had just been opened, just barely opened to outside world. And a photographer in Kathmandu invited me to come if I could come right away and go. And we did. We went on horseback up to Lo Montang. This Mustang, or Montang it really is, is a kingdom just near Dolpo, where I went for the snow leopard trip. And it's an old kingdom of Tibet. Absolutely fascinating. And I did a book called East of Lo Montang with wonderful photographs.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with famed novelist and nature writer, literary great, and even Zen master, Peter Matheson, about a world in crisis and maybe this American moment. You may know him from The Snow Leopard. This is the 30th anniversary of its publication, and so many others. Shadow Country, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, The Cloud Forest, At Play in the Fields of the Lord, Far Tortuga. Marie is on the line from Lexington, Virginia. Marie, you're on the air with Peter Matheson.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd just like to say I think you're very on point today to bring a breath of fresh air into the middle of our political wranglings and to help us to think about more deeply about who we are and what we are and why we do what we do and why we want to do what we want to do. Peter Matheson, I've never read his books, but I was moved by the passage that he read, and it just made me think, yeah, we need to stop and think about the air and the trees and the ground that we walk on.
We'll do it, Marie. There's a lot more that's great where that came from, the passage in the Snow Leopard and much more. Peter Matheson, what about it? Give us a little. I mean, you are literally a Zen master. It sounds kind of over grand, but it's a status you've worked to achieve. So give us a little, just for starters, Zen lesson on the moment. Zen Buddhism says all is illusion. So does that mean you don't care when things are crumbling and crashing down economically or elsewise?
Well, first of all, let me say that I really don't speak here as a Zen master, unquote. I never call myself that, but the term keeps coming up on this program.
Well, but it's, you're a roshi. You've practiced.
I know that officially I am. I mean, not officially, but I am. That's where I am in our lineage and so forth. But I think of myself as a Zen student, a Zen monk at the most, not
good.
A master.
All right.
So I don't speak it that way. But and I don't really speak much about Zen because many people, unless they're really looking into it, don't really care to hear about it, and they're made, in fact, uncomfortable by it. I'm just, old geezer here. So,
well, but Marie says she wants exactly that kind of perspective, so try us
all
out.
Right. Well, you said you referred to being a Zen master in this moment. Well, and this moment for me is the heart of Zen. It's exactly where we are. This is the only reality from a Zen perspective, is this moment, moment after moment, breath after breath. Everything else is delusion in the way we see it. There are two realities. There's the relative reality, which we have to certainly abide by. That's the way our life is, the way it's what it's composed of. But right with it, accompanying it, is the absolute reality, which in Zen practice one has a glimpse of now and again, and it's what gives resonance in a way to our entire life and to our spiritual, perception and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to, give a jiffy lesson on Buddhism. I don't want to speak superficially about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think Zen perspective is very close to what a wise perspective would be, approach from any other discipline or point of view. And I think that's what we need. We need wisdom and leadership and all those things in great amounts, and very soon, if we're to survive this.
When you look at our great and terrible nation, or great and terrible humanity at this moment, do you feel kind of in-the-moment quality in our assessment of circumstances that's grounded, that's at grips with the what you may see as fundamentals? And I don't mean economic fundamentals. I guess I mean something even broader than that behind this moment. People are wondering, where are we going to be, you know, a week from now, a year from now? Where's this economy headed? What about all my plans? Where's my 401k headed? People are really worried about those issues. Do those look to you like the right issues?
Well, they are certainly the immediate issues, and just as and right behind them, of course, is Iraq and global warming, and I think an impending water shortage worldwide, and the spreading inequity between rich and poor. I think Obama touched on that last night, but it's a very, very, very prominent and you know, destructive problem. I do think this is a great nation, and I think that's why I'm so angry and so appalled at the assault on our environment, on our air, our health programs, education, everything. It just doesn't do our country credit. We are great, and we've betrayed our country in this way with all this false patriotism and flag waving, you know, and yet we've just let our country down, our constitution down, and we're threatening to vote in a very right-wing Supreme Court that's going to reverse all the progress we've made, just as the deregulation has reversed all the progress. For example, I worked for so many years as an environmentalist, mm-hmm. and we've just watched all of that progress be undone by this administration and its collusion with the big oil and other corporations. It's just shocking. I even last night I noticed to my horror, I was watching mm-hmm. CNN briefly after mm-hmm. the debate, and I saw that ExxonMobil, by God, was one of the sponsors of that program. How is big oil? Why should there have a place when we're supposed to be having an objective, nonpartisan electoral debate? Mm. Why are they there yet again at the table telling us about how much progress they're making with the environment when they've done nothing but undercut everything in regard to progress and alternative energies and so forth for years? Mm. A totally bandit company, as far as I see. And yet there they are, you know. I don't like, as a Zen so-called master, mm. it doesn't behoove me to be enraged, but I often feel pure rage at these corporations. When do they learn? When do they start taking care of their own children and grandchildren? When do they start sharing the wealth? They just won't do it. And the American people should be bloody mad. They should be outraged. I'm amazed at how calm they really are in the face of how much is taken away and how much these people have indulged themselves in the administration and out of it.
Give us the long view here, though. Let us take advantage of it. You're 81 now. I mean, there you were in the U.S. Navy, 44 to 46, right coming out of World War II. What did you expect when and if you thought of it, when you looked ahead, if you can think back, here was the country victorious, America rising, the American century, it would come to be called. I don't know if you can recall how you looked ahead, how you imagined the country might be set when you were 81. But here we are. Do you imagine?
That was the last thing I was thinking.
Well, but you must have had a sense of direction for the country, where
well,
you hoped or imagined it would go.
Yes. I mean, I don't know how much I was thinking ahead then. I wasn't really very wise. I was pretty childish. And I was thinking ahead to my own first novel, and I was thinking all sorts of exciting things. And I thought that the United States would progress normally the way we'd already expected and been taught and read about and in our history and so forth. I had not expected that it would decline in this way. We don't have to go back that far. If we go back to 1989, we came out of the Cold War with this enormous surplus amount of money that we could have done anything with, for infrastructure, education, health programs, anything, all of those things, the environment. And what have we done with it? We have just bloody well squandered it on a false and bogus, really, intrusion into other people and other nations and so forth, and we're not getting the job done. And I don't know. I think about the waste of all these young people, these young kids, male and female, who lost their lives or been permanently maimed and mangled in Iraq and Afghanistan. And for what? Afghanistan, we can understand, but Iraq, it's just, and the billions and billions, all of that, wealth that we've wasted, it's just for what? For ego, for mistakes, for ambition, for stupidity. It is really something. And how can anybody in their right mind want to vote to perpetuate that situation? It just it truly boggles the mind. And I'm sorry, I don't doubt that I sound cranky and so forth, but I don't care. This is very important, folks. We have to take care of this right away in the next few weeks and make sure that the worst doesn't happen.
We'll touch it more, but there are so many listeners who want to come directly to you. Stephen in Nellisford, Virginia, you're on the air with Peter Matheson.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. What's on your mind, Stephen?
I'd like to ask Mr. Matheson. 22 years after he did the Snow Leopard trek, I trekked up to Dalpo through, during that exciting area. And I wanted to talk to him about when he went through Yamakar. He described going through the village and this child beating on a drum and the men standing up on the roofs, sort of staring down him on a glum face.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I went there 22 years later, it was virtually the identical scene. On the trail coming up from the creek, there was chicken guts staked out on the ground, and we sort of thought, like, whoa, what's this? And then we get to the village, the kid is beating on a plastic drum, and the people are staring at us with this glum look, and we think, what gives? And I happened to have a walking stick flute, so I started playing flute with the drum. And everybody's expression changed. It was really a remarkable experience. We had the
Stephen, let's bring it to Peter Matheson. And Peter, there, a traveler on your turf, Dalpo, inner Dalpo, and with your words in mind as he made that trip.
Well, I think that's wonderful to hear an echo of the trip that way. And, of course, that's one of the attractions of going on that journey was the fact that the region is so little changed. And not only that, you're walking into the past. Every 100 miles, you're another century into the past. And that was thrilling. We were walking into the past. We were walking from summer into winter. It had that extraordinary shift of time and space and place that was wonderful. But nonetheless, the denizens of the region are like we are. I mean, we're all human beings, and some of them are glum, and some of them are beating on drums. That's who we are, and that's absolutely great. But it's kind of nice to know that people living in a wholly different realm and a different, really an age, are so much like us.
The earth is ringing, all is moving, full of power, full of light, you wrote, walking through that terrain, Peter Matheson's The Snow Leopard in 1978, and our caller a few years later. I wanted to ask you about that perspective of those who haven't lost a lot of money in the last couple of weeks because they don't have any. And a whole lot of people in this world fall into that category. You've written about the dispossessed, about indigenous people. You've gone to all corners of the planet, and very often with an eye on those populations that aren't part of the global economy or anything beyond almost sustenance. You mentioned inequality before. I wish you'd just speak to why it matters or how it may frame what's going on, even in the sort of jet set right now.
You mean the contrast between those
people?
Well,
the contrast, but also the interaction. I mean, for a lot of years, it seemed to me we just assumed that the sort of glory economy would sail on almost without regard for those who weren't part of it, and it didn't
totally
really seem to matter.
Regard. Totally without regard, with working people in this country who work under appalling conditions for very small wages and so forth. I think the capitalist system, which would certainly include the people, my people and people I grew up with, we're absolutely conditioned to ignore human poverty and suffering, sickness and so forth. We're protected from it on every level. We put our lawyers in there in the Congress. They're all lawyers. Everything, every system, every apparatus we have, every mechanism, in a way, shelters us from facing what we do with poor people, not all around the world, but also in our own country. Look what we've done with our American Indian people and our black people. And every minority that's ever come in here has had it, been suffered terribly. But somehow we don't look at them. We don't want to look at them. I don't mean all of us, but of course there are people really concerned about it and working very hard to try to leaven that situation. But nonetheless, it's amazing what we can do to blind ourselves.
And when your other great cause has been the environment, a lot of attention paid to that lately. People really getting turned. Al Gore and others making a big noise. Everybody talking about a green future at this point. But how goes the battle? I mean, do you see enough progress on that front to give comfort, or is that another part of the meltdown we're facing now?
Well, no, I haven't given up hope. I think we've won a lot of battles, whether we're winning the overall war or not. I'm not so sure. We are still doing a tremendous amount of damage. We're doing nothing about overpopulation. You know, we are very big mammals. We're a big species, and we're enormously polluting. And we take up an enormous amount of air and space, and we seem to have no concern about pushing all other species off the globe. And I think that's another thing we have to face. We have so many things right now to face. But nonetheless, you know, it's amazing what resilience life has. You see things coming back, creatures coming back, given any sort of chance at all. You know, 50 years ago, the whooping crane was down to 16 birds in captivity and in the wild, absolutely written off. There was no hope for that bird. It was just too far gone. Well, now there are perhaps 400, 450 in the wild and in captivity because people meant business and they went after this and they solved a lot of the problems. And there's hope. And this is true of a number of species. On the other hand, we're losing our songbirds where I live here at a terrible rate. It's really discouraging to see it. I've lost a great many of the small songbird species on my small property there in Sagaponack. But curiously enough, I have, surrounded by civilization, I have both turkey and deer. These large creatures have come in numbers and live right around my office. Mm-hmm. It seems it's a bizarre situation, but it's still encouraging.
Goodbye to the songbird and hello to the turkey and deer, yeah. the big ones, but not quite ones. The same beautiful song. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with famed novelist and nature writer, literary great Zen student, as he has it, Peter Matheson, about a world in crisis and this American moment, 30th anniversary of the publication of his The Snow Leopard right now. Penguin Classics is out with a new edition. And so many more that so many readers have treasured over the years. Far Tortuga, At Play in the Fields of the Lord, The Cloud Forest, and The Spirit of Crazy Horse, and many more. Let's take a call from East Callis, Vermont, and Howard, I think you may know Peter Matheson pretty well.
Yes, I wanted to say really quickly that I think Mr. Matheson really deserves the Nobel Prize in Peace for his environmental advocacy and in fiction. The question I have for Peter is a rather personal one about being a writer. The Japanese writer Akutagawa said, "What good is intelligence if you can't discover a useful melancholy?" And I think in Peter's writing about wild places and in his fiction, especially the Watson trilogy, I think that the books are elegiac and that they do have a kind of useful melancholy in the sense that they are celebrations, but at the same time laments. And I just wanted to ask Peter how he, I guess the term I would say is fends off a kind of pernicious sadness or melancholy about some some of the subjects he writes about, the loss of wild places and so on and so forth. And hello to Peter.
This is Howard Norman. I think you interviewed Peter, wonderful interview for the Paris Review some years ago, Howard.
Well,
yes.
No, Howard, imagine meeting you here. I hadn't expected to hear your voice.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
No, I'm delighted. Let me make sure I understand your question. Were you talking about melancholy?
Yes, I'm really asking.
Were you inquiring about my melancholy? Yes.
Not precisely in an autobiographical sense, but the idea of pouring a kind of vigilance and sadness and sort of pointillist emotions into the work you, the writing that you do about wildlife areas, and how do you personally fend off a kind of unavoidable sense of loss in your writing?
I don't think you do fend it off. You just have to live with it and keep going. Sure, that makes me melancholy. I remember a wonderful letter that Rachel Carson wrote to a friend of hers, and how, to the effect that she woke every day with a sense of loss and for things that were being lost and being abused and being thrown away through indifference or ignorance and so forth. And of course that's saddening, because one thinks how much we're depriving our children and our grandchildren, who will never see the world that we're seeing right now. But I've learned lately, I've cheered up only slightly, because I realize that they don't really care. I mean, if you say to the kids, hey, you know, this is the way it was, you know, well, okay, but they don't care about that. They care about the way it is now. And they can, in their turn, say to their kids, hey, you should have seen it the way it was. Yeah. I mean, the fact that we're progressively losing ground is sort of lost. But I think we'll keep right on doing that until we're brought to a violent stop with an emergency of, or emergencies of many kinds.
Do you feel that Howard quotes Akitagawa, the Japanese writer, talking about useful melancholy? Have you felt that dynamic in it, Peter?
Yes, I think melancholy is useful if it makes you pause and reflect and think about things a little, rather than just plunging forward, using up your life kind of blindly. I think the melancholy does lead to reflection. So it has a use, of course, and it's not negative entirely by any means.
Howard, do you end up lifted in spite of the melancholy? And you can certainly feel it in many of the travel books, but do you end up lifted in spite of it, Howard?
I'm sorry?
In Peter Matheson's writing, do you end up elevated in spite of that sort of frank melancholy at points?
Absolutely. I think it's, as Peter's suggesting, it can be an intensifying element to your sense of focus and attentiveness, you know, Peter really does that, amongst other things, better than any living writer. And my question was as much about the sustaining qualities of his writing as it is his personal life and his life as an environmental activist.
Howard Norman, thanks very much for calling in from Vermont. It's great
to
have you.
Thank you, Howard. You're too kind, Howard.
Hardly.
The Nobel, no less. Let's go to Naples, Florida, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air with Peter Matheson.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a plant ecologist in Southwest Florida, and, you know, we've got a lot of environmental problems in Southwest Florida, as I know Peter's aware. One of the issues, and I see regular evidence of sea level rise, and all indications are that it's happening more rapid than it was in the past, including when we had civilizations occupying the coast. But so many people here, even with my direct conversations, they continue to deny or belittle the problem of CO2 emissions. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering how somebody who's spent his life dealing with environmental issues, you know, how can I maintain hope for this species in this country?
Should I answer that, Tom?
Yes, please.
Well, I don't know that I can. I just wanted to inquire who should do this. Well, you do have to go on, don't you? You can blow your brains out. That's another alternative. But you do kind of have to go on and plug away and do the best you can do. And I think for environmentalists, you know, at the least, you're educating the next generation, which is always a plus, you know. And furthermore, you're forestalling some of the bad effects. This is what the environmental groups, in large part, have accomplished, the best of them have, that they've put off. They have this legislation. It's true that the recent administration has undone all it can and for the benefit of the corporations. But nonetheless, there are, there's a whole body of legislation out there that was enacted since World War II, very impressive, too. And some of it, of course, is still intact. And that is slowing down the stubborn tendency in our species to destroy our habitat. So I think it gives me hope that we are doing that, that we are fighting certain things. We're at least still talking about saving the Everglades. Whether that will go through or not, I don't know. I'm going to be dealing with some of that coming down to Florida this later in the fall. But anyhow, you just whether you are hopeful practically, from a practical point of view or not, I think you're obliged, responsible to keep on fighting as hard as you can, as best you can.
And what about Mike refers to the skepticism about the human role in global warming or the denial of the human role? Governor Palin, Sarah Palin, voicing that just last week in her debate with Joe Biden again. What do you make of the persistence of that skepticism, that denial?
I think it's in the same. Mrs. Palin also is a creationist. She believes that the whole Darwin theory, survival of the fittest, and everything, evolution, is nonsense, and that she's a creationist, as she cheerfully admits. And so people are, those things, however, seem to go together, and I think that they tend to support a kind of a reactionary philosophy of life that doesn't need any thought. You know, this is our opinion, and my dad had that opinion, my granddad too, and why the hell should I change it, you know, for you, elite people? And, you know, I think it's part of that whole mentality. What's scary is that mentality might be living in the White House before we know it. So I don't want to be strident here and go off on my soapbox again, but still, that's there. We have to deal with that mentality. Fundamentalism, whatever form it takes, all over the world, it seems to me to be causing all of the trouble. I don't care where you find it. Mm-hmm. That idea that we have the right view and other people don't, that leads to discrimination and eventually to things like genocide. So pretty scary.
So watch out. Mike in Naples, thanks for calling. Let's go to El Paso, Texas, and Bill. Bill, you're on the air with Peter Matheson.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wanted to get into the aspect of the here and now versus the future. I actually started in alternative energy in 1984, thinking I could go out and make some money and save the world at the same time. And it just seemed like everything was stacked against me. And it just seems in life that people are in the here and now, and they don't consider the future. They speak of our children and grandchildren, but it just seems right up to a corporate level that everything is the almighty dollar and the here and now and instant gratification. And I was hoping we could kind of address how, you know, not that I'm into Zen or know much about Zen, but how does the moment and the future come together, and how do we as a species correct this issue so as to have a future that's something that we all would like for ourselves and our children?
Peter Matheson, give us a little perspective, even Zen perspective, if you're kind enough.
If I could really answer that question, I would be running for president, too. I'd tell Obama and McCain to get out of the way. I would have the solution to everything, and I would probably be a fundamentalist on top of that. I just don't know. We all work, and we do what we can in our particular field, in our area, and as, again, we try to educate the next generation coming up. But there is no overall solution except were we to be blessed suddenly with an enormous amount of wisdom and a sense of proportion about the effect of our species on this planet.
But you spoke earlier about in the Zen practice of the focus on, you know, breath, just breath after breath. You can't get much more right now than that. And you can hear Bill, who went out with foresight rather than just living breath after breath, in 1984 to work on alternative energy and didn't find a receptive world for that. You can understand how he might think, well, golly, Breath after breath is great, but what about foresight?
Breath after breath, we're talking about one's personal existence, one's awareness of the forces of life and so forth. In our relative existence, which we have to pay attention to because the other doesn't exist without it, you know, you have to pay attention. That really is a truck bearing down on you. You might get run over. But there it's appropriate, the breath after breath, moment after moment. This is the way Zen trains you to pay attention to your life. But that doesn't mean there's not another reality that we have to deal with. And one of them is just as the caller was talking about. You know, it is discouraging, this living in the only for the moment and so forth. It's quite different from the moment by moment I'm talking about.
Bill, thanks for calling. Let's get a call from Providence, Rhode Island. And John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Matheson.
Hi.
Hi, I was wondering what your Zen perspective is on, I read in the Spirit of Crazy Horse, and you've written about the injustice of the native people. I'm wondering if you can compare today the plight of the native people in the 70s, and what's your perspective, or the Zen perspective, on injustice, as in the case of Leonard Peltier, who served 32 years in prison, accused of killing two FBI agents, but the prosecutor even admitted at an appeals trial that they don't know who shot their agents.
Peter Matheson, well, you've been right in the middle of that whole controversy and certainly writing about that neck of American life.
Yeah, and I just want to mention, Leonard actually called up a few days ago. We stay in touch. We've been in touch for over 30 years now, I guess. Not quite. No, that's not true. About 28 years. Mm-hmm. And he's amazingly courageous. He just does not whine about anything. The only time I ever heard him really sound discouraged and defeated was the day that Clinton left office without having given him clemency, but mm-hmm. giving it to a great many other undeserving people. Leonard is an amazing example of courage, it seems to me. And it's also, unfortunately, of injustice, which most of his judges even now kind of agree. He's long overdue. He's coming up for parole in January. We should all try to get behind him. He's in there 32 years, and he should be automatically out at 30 years. But the fact, because he's been labeled a, quote, cop killer, unquote, they just don't, the FBI especially, just does not want to give him a breath of air. They're going to keep him in there forever. And it's a very, very distressing case. We just have not been able to get him out.
What have you thought as Native Americans have come into a new kind of prominence in this country through casinos, Peter Matheson?
I don't love the idea of casinos because inevitably, if they're very successful, they'll be taken over by not necessarily criminal interests, but nonetheless very self-serving interests. And it's a question whether the Indian people will be benefited in the end. On the other hand, they have been so ill-used, they've driven to this kind of thing. We put them on reservations, which are terrible land, not mostly desert and so forth, and then we expect them to survive anyway. Well, I think if the casinos come along and it helps that group of people survive, I have to say I'm all for it. I'm wary of it, but I'm all for it.
And as you look out now, we heard you right from the top, really focused on an election just 4 weeks from now. With the economic turmoil around us, election sitting right there, do you feel hope? Do you give yourself that luxury? Are you yourself more skeptical at this point? You know, what's your attitude toward this big troubled picture we're looking at?
I'll have hope if the election goes a certain way on November 4th. That would be an enormous infusion of hope, not just for me, but for millions of people around the world. And I think without that, there's going to be an overwhelming despair. And of course, we'll do our best. We'll make the best of it. We have to. We have no choice about that. And we will. And no doubt we'll, in the end, survive. But it's going to take years and years longer, I think, to put this country back on its proper course. A country we can be proud of and will be admired and loved the world over.
Peter Matheson, author of The Snow Leopard, Shadow Country, and much more on the 30th anniversary year of the Snow Leopard's publication. It's been wonderful speaking with you. Thank you very much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks very much for having me and let me rant on here.
No, very, very great to have you. I should say Penguin Classics and the Union of Concerned Scientists are working to gather American climate change stories and photographs to be put into a new book. Peter Matheson's supporting this and asks us to tell you. You can go to ucsusa.org/American Studies to contribute, or at our website. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.